Hello and welcome to the TV Movie Rewind Podcast with Matt and Todd.
Hi, everyone.
This week we are doing the 1987 comedy buddy cop homage to the classic television show Dragnet, starring Dan Aykroyd and Tom Hanks, written and directed by Tom Mankiewicz. Now, when we first saw this movie back in 87, we saw it in the theater. Mm-hmm. And we were able to enjoy it perfectly fine.
Yep.
But I don't think either one of us really... I mean, we knew of the Dragnet TV show. I mean, it was still very popular in reruns.
Right.
I mean, even today, the dun-dun-dun-dun is the most famous, you know, sting when it comes to any type of, you know, police procedural or anything like that.
We were definitely aware of it because it was on in reruns. Might have even seen an episode or two, but it also had a bit of a resurgence because of the movie. So, you know, we were aware of it. It was in the consciousness, even if we didn't watch it.
I mean,
we knew where Dan Aykroyd was going, what he was trying to do, but couldn't necessarily appreciate it with real context because we hadn't necessarily seen Jack Webb yet.
I mean, the character Joe Friday would pop up in cartoons as well.
Right, right.
You know,
like we knew the archetype. We knew what they were going for.
Right. I mean, it is really the... I don't know if it's the original police procedural, but it's one of the earliest and, again, most popular. I have seen most of the TV series, especially the late 60s revival. Yeah. I've seen mostly that one, and I've listened to a lot of the old radio show, which, you know, you can find that on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, that they, you know, any place that's running classic radio shows is running Dragnet. And, you know, it's a fun, you know, it's almost a, you know, a self-parody now, especially with, you know, seeing this. But I remember enjoying the early 90s relaunch with Ed O'Neill as Joe Friday.
Yeah.
You know, it's a classic cop show. Let's face it. I don't even know if Law and Order would be a thing if it hadn't been for Dragnet.
No, I think definitely not. In fact, I think Dick Wolf had said that Law and Order is Dragnet is absolutely an inspiration. Like, he was a huge fan of Dragnet. So I who knows if he would have come up on with it on his own, but certainly it was an inspiration. Yeah.
But yeah, this show, you know, it pokes fun at, you know, Dragnet, but it's obviously they did their homework. It's as much an homage as it is a parody.
Right.
You know, right. They, even though, you know, that you're kind of, you know, giving a wink and a nudge to the Joe Friday character, they still, you respect him because, you know, he's just trying to be the good, honest cop.
He's as straight laced as possibly, you know, possible, but he's not unreasonable either in his own way. You know, I mean, he's difficult, but not, he's not like mean, you know? But yeah, he's just incredibly straight laced.
No. And he's very, you know, black is black, white is white. There's no gray area when this comes to the interpretation of the law.
Right.
Although just before, you know, I want to mention that to me, the best Joe Friday parody will always be Philip Baker Hall playing Joe Bookman, the library cop, in that episode of Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Great actor. I mean, he was always tremendous in anything he is, but when he comes into Seinfeld's apartment and starts going through his spiel about, you know, a kid's right to be able to read without having his mind warped.
Right.
You're into that, Seinfeld. He is just, it is such a great, great parody of Joe Friday that even Jerry Seinfeld can barely keep a straight face. Well, he can't keep a straight face.
Right. Yeah, he's breaking. Thing. Yeah. That's a fantastic, absolutely. No, and that's one of the things that still works for me about this movie. When I rewatched it for the first time in probably two or three decades, just a couple months ago, when I got it on DVD, I, you know, I was watching it and I was just like, you know, this still works for me, or at least, you know, the vast majority of it does. You know, just to pick one example of many that we'll get through as we go, Dan Aykroyd's amazing in this. Like, I just love hearing him. I just love listening to him talk. Even if I don't, like, you know, even if it's kind of like you're rolling your eyes, it's just, it's poetry. He speaks with a poetry that's just hard to, it's hard to, you know, I don't know. I love it.
This was one of the hardest Whit Bissell Awards to pick because the entire cast is just fantastic. I mean, Christopher Plummer.
Yeah.
As the Reverend Worley is amazing.
He's incredible, but it felt weird to give him the Whit Bissell. It's just the only reason.
Because Christopher Plummer.
Right, because he's Christopher Plummer. And he's the main, he's the main antagonist, I guess, or, you know, semi-antagonist. But yeah, he's brilliant. He's brilliant as the Reverend.
And the chemistry and back and forth between Hanks and Aykroyd is perfect. Yeah.
Oh, Tom Hanks is great in this. I mean, it's a Dan Aykroyd vehicle, I suppose. But I don't know who else I could put here. But Tom Hanks, he does it. His Pepstream Beck is just works so well. They work so well together.
Yeah, and this wouldn't be long before he's, you know, winning Oscars in, you know, Philadelphia and Forrest Gump either.
Right.
You know, just a few years. I mean, he was still mostly, I don't know if he'd done any, well, Family Ties, where he played the drunk uncle that punches Alex.
Right. I can't remember when Big was.
I think Big was just after this. I think Big was
it just
next
after?
Role.
Yeah. Like, he's done great in this. His timing is perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, Bachelor Party, right.
And Volunteers, and I think he'd already done The Money Pit, and obviously he'd already done Bosom Buddies and stuff like that.
And like Mazes and Monsters, probably.
Yeah.
I assume which that was before.
Which was an early dramatic role for him, so.
Yep.
But let's get into the movie. It starts off with the exact tone and intro as the Dragnet TV show with a voiceover of, you know, Dan Aykroyd as Joe Friday saying this is the city and giving the whole spiel, almost a travelogue of LA. And, you know, I work here. I carry a badge. My name's Friday. And then he, you know, he marches into the police precinct as the, you know, classic Dragnet theme starts, but then goes into kind of a more rap, hip hop type of, because it's 1987, and right. As you will find out, like, all these movies have to end with a rap song or have some sort of upbeat, you know, techno music. And he gets in and he gets into his desk, and now we find out how this show connects, how this movie connects to the original show.
Yeah, I mean, with the theme, like, everybody was trying to still make the next Ghostbusters.
Yes. Hit,
you know, like they, like everyone was like, this will get radio play. This will be the next, like, who are you going to call?
He gets to his desk and he announces his partner is Frank Smith, which is a callback to, I know the radio show, the partner was Frank Smith. I don't know about some of the, I don't remember the earlier Dragnet episodes, but then Frank Gannon, Harry Morgan as Captain Bill Gannon comes in, and Harry Morgan is reprising his role from the 1967 series where he played Bill Gannon, Joe Friday's partner, and we find out that he is the nephew of the original Joe Friday. We see a picture of Jack Webb as the original Joe Friday on his desk, right next to a pack of Chesterfield cigarettes, which is what the original Joe Friday smoked. And I guess Chesterfield was also a sponsor of the original radio show. So two homages right there. And we find out that, yes, Joe Friday, I don't know if it's the second if you're the nephew, but the next generation Joe Friday is just like his uncle.
Yes. He gets all of his cues from, yeah, he gets all of his cues from his uncle.
And he finds out that his partner has, like, retired to buy a goat farm.
Yes.
And, again, it's like,
Which things move fast in the LAPD, apparently, because that's a quick retirement. Like, you know, that's usually announced ahead of time. Did he just not notice?
Until yeah. Then, you know? There's usually some paperwork, you know, you work up to your final day.
Like things, we'll find out things move really fast on this version of the LAPD.
Because he's assigned his new partner immediately.
Yes.
Which I guess would probably have to happen.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how quickly, but yeah. Yeah. That's the least of it, though.
You know, when Bill Gannon's talking to Friday and saying, Frank said you would understand. And you know, Friday's like, yeah, I understand. But will the millions of citizens who pay their taxes and expect him to be on the job today, will they understand, Captain? And that was a...
That's my favorite running gag.
Yeah. But that was the same thing as, again, in the old show where, you know, Friday would always be like, well, it's not me doing this. It's the citizens. Right. I'm doing it for the citizens. This is all in the protection of the good and honest citizens of L.A.
And I think that's just an interesting choice. Like it's almost like, you know, it's. I just think it's interesting that the way they decide to do it is they just make him, anachronistic, right? Like basically he just has not progressed with the times and you know refuses to, but is still you know what I do like about him though is that you know as much of a hardo as he is. He's quick to at least mention what he could do before he actually does it. You know what I mean? Like he will tell you that you jaywalked, but he might not necessarily take it you then and there for it type of thing.
Right. Or
he's got restraint.
Say, if it were up to me, we'd throw you in a hole and you know right. bury you forever.
Right.
But lucky for you, it's not. You're gonna get your fair trial.
Right. He's just super hardcore. And that's just where most of the comedy comes from is just everybody's reaction to that. And I don't know. I think it works. I love Dan Aykroyd in this so much. I love this character so much. Not because, you know, not necessarily because I'm agreeing with him, but it's just he speaks with this poetry that is just, I don't know. It really works for me.
All very deadpanned, even and matter of fact.
Right.
So we're quickly introduced to his new partner, played by Tom Hanks, Pep Strebeck.
Pep, yeah.
And, you know, we get right off that, you know, Pep is not really all for the rules and regulations. But he's, you know, because he comes up in his dilapidated jalopy and, you know,
dressed he rolls like in looking like Riggs.
Yes.
You know, yeah.
And they don't say it, but he was obviously undercover. But when, you know, when Joe Friday gets one look at him, he's like, I don't care what undercover rock you crawled out from under. But there are regulations for a plainclothes detective in this department. And then he goes off to read a list of numbers that I really, really tried.
Oh, did you? Did you try to verify?
2.1, 2.5, 2.8. All these dress code violations that require him to wear, you know, a suit, a tie, and leather shoes, preferably with high polish on them. And they don't show it, but did he drag him to the nearest men's warehouse to outfit him with his new clothes?
Right. Yeah, he just suddenly has them, and he approves. He just gives us nodding approval.
And they're given their first assignment, which is to investigate the pagan organization. There has been a series of crimes hitting the city where little business cards like that say pagan have been left behind.
And it's all printed out like an acronym that we'll find later.
And they're mostly petty nuisance crimes.
It's just the acronym, what you find out, like, I don't know, that still works for me. It still makes me chuckle. It's so simple, but it still makes me chuckle.
But there's also been an increase in stolen cars and all sorts of things. So their first assignment is to go to the L.A. Zoo, where a lion and a zookeeper had been drugged, and a fruit tree bat and anaconda were stolen. And they get to the zoo and they meet a zookeeper, and you know, she shows them that the pagan cards were left behind at the crime, and you know, they're being interviewed by, you know, but they're interviewing the snake lady, and you know, she's given her, and we get the first "just the facts, ma'am," as he's trying to take his notes, and you know, we get some actual decent police procedural where, like, he asks, like, you know, what's the normal diet of this type of anaconda? And, you know, Pep gets the snarky remark of, like, oh, you thinking about getting a new pet? And he answers quite factually, like, whoever stole it's got to feed it. Right. So if we know what they got to feed it, you know, that might help us track it down. Then he asks about the average weight of the average fruit tree bat. And again, Strebeck's got to be snarky and say, you mean you don't know? Again, I'm not entirely sure, you know, where that's going.
Yeah.
And then they go to the lion cage, and she's like, you know, the Zuki's like, this is the one I understand least of all. And they show that the male lion has had his mane shaved down to a mohawk.
Which kind of looks rad, but I'm sure the lion doesn't appreciate it.
Well, and even, you know, Pep says, well, as mohawks go, it's not that bad. Right. It'll grow back.
Right.
And
which leads Variety
goes right into his, look, yeah, I know that, and you know that. But how are you going to tell it to these kids who've never seen a lion before, may never want to see a lion again? And she just turns to it, hey, kids, it'll grow back. And all the kids cheer.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, you know, you just give the kids the down low and they'll be all ready for it.
Right. It's just there.
So they go to lunch. And again, the basic, you know, premise of the, you know, and most buddy cop comedies do this anyways. You know, there's always the, you know, the odd couple take on the two main cops. And right from when they go to lunch and you know, he's going to go for some chili dogs. And it's odd to me that from what we know about Pep Strebeck, that he's so fastidious about what he eats.
Right.
And, you know, he gets a fruit salad and Friday gets his chili dogs, and you know, he's like, oh, you know, they're loaded with nitrates and they're terrible for you. And Friday, just again, because again, Friday's a meat and potatoes guy. You know, that's who he is. All American, meat and potatoes, hot dogs, and cigarettes. And that's what he says, you know, besides a cigarette, I only have one vice, and a good chili dog is it. So leave me alone, let me eat my lunch. And that's when he has to say, very cruelly, you know what can fall into your average sausage pret? You know, not excluding rat hairs and bug excrement. He very flat out states, I hate you, Strebeck.
Yeah, that's great delivery.
So from there, they go to their next call is to a Jerry Caesar played again by the excellent Dabney Coleman.
Oh, he's amazing.
You know, he's a Hugh Hefner style character. He has a magazine called Bait Magazine. And he has, you know, basically the equivalent of the Playboy Mansion with all these, you know, gorgeous women all over the place. You know, Pep Strebeck is in his element, but Friday, of course, finds it all very distasteful. You know,
oh, yeah, he's revolted.
This is the city of angels, and here he has built his own Sodom and Gomorrah right here in, you know, in the middle of it. And
I think the magazine's called Bait. And they say Bait Mate like 40 times.
Yeah.
It's a PG-13 movie.
Was it? You know what? It must have been, because, yeah, it played on 87. During the day a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, they're going to cast all these gorgeous women who are walking around the grounds. And, you know, they meet one named April, who Pep Strebeck recognizes immediately. And he's able to give her stats like, oh, and, you know, your favorite movies are 2001 and Yes, Giorgio. And
A Sound of Music. With Sound of Music.
A Sound of Music. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Sound of Music. With, you know, again, reference to Christopher Plummer. And, you know, what she doesn't like, and she doesn't like men who smoke in public places. And she grabs Friday's cigarette.
Mr. Silly. I like how she calls him Mr. Silly.
Yes. Yeah. She's very, you know.
She's very nice.
friendly, yes. And you know, and yeah. So she brings them to Dabney Coleman playing Jerry Caesar, and again, he even adds this little speech impediment to his character, yep. That you know, for whatever reason, but it's endearing.
It just works. It works. I love hearing him talk, and that's one of the things with this movie. Like, acting can be underrated in comedy, and everybody is just fantastic in this. Really sinking into their character. Like Christopher Plummer just sinks into the reference character, and it works out so well for us.
And you know, he's sitting, you know, he's lounging in a sun chair between two gorgeous women. One of them played by Donna Spear, who was an actual playmate, and some folks might know her from the Andy Sedaris movie. She starred in a couple of those. I won't say how I recognized her. I'll just throw that out there as a completely right. unrelated factoid. So, yeah, they're interviewing him because the Pagans have stolen the entire print run of his 250th anniversary issue. The 25th anniversary issue.
25th anniversary,
of his Bait magazine, which, you know, Friday refers to as, you know, his smut rag.
Smut rag, yeah.
And he's like, you say. Some people call it like some sort of political, you know, commentary.
His Dan Aykroyd's delivery of this magazine just works for me every time. It gets a smile out of me every time. I just love the way he says that.
But again, true to his character, as much as he doesn't like it, he goes, you know, you've got the First Amendment right to do it. I don't like it. I don't think it should be done. But there's nothing illegal about it, and it is my job to track down this magazine. And it's like, how much is the print run of your magazine worth? And he's like, let's just say it's more than you'll ever see in a lifetime.
At least my money's clean. Before you go home polishing your pennies. polishing your pennies. It's just fun to talk like him.
He's fantastic, and I think we both discussed that he was almost our Whip Thistle Award winner.
Damn near, either him, I mean, there was a lot of good choices,
So they start to put together that, you know, we kind of skipped over at the beginning because the opening of the movie shows the theft of the magazines being conducted by Jack O'Halloran playing Emil Muzz.
Yes.
And they're able
could win the damn award. He's one of the more memorable characters of the movie.
They put together that, you know, okay, this Emil Muzz, you know, who is also Jerry Caesar's chauffeur, you know, may be kind of crooked because they are called to what was once a motel and is now a apartment complex where Emil lives, but they've been called there by the landlord, Edith Borman, played by
Kathleen Freeman,
who is both our Whip Whistle Award winner.
Yeah, she's only in this one scene, but it's one of the best scenes of the movie.
But she dominates it.
Absolutely, she kills it.
She just is like hostile.
Oh yeah.
I mean, beyond
so hostile. Vile. But so vile, but the insults she comes up with, they're just great. I won't repeat any of them, much less try to deliver them like she does. But if you've seen this movie, you know what we're talking about. If you haven't, then, you know, you're in for a treat. Or you'll be horrified, whichever. It's not that bad. It's 87 in a PG-13 movie, but it's pretty good.
After she screams at, you know, at Friday and Strebeck and discusses how much she despises and how awful a tenant Emil Muzz was and how he threw all his stuff out. You know, most people wouldn't have bothered, but I got a high, goddammit.
And she comes up with a different elaborate insult, like multi-staged insult every time.
And other than the profanity, this is definitely a throwback, especially to the radio show. Where it seemed like in every episode, Joe Friday has to deal with some sort of hostile eyewitness or a hostile person who's come to the station to swear out a complaint and treats Joe Friday like he's not only the person who committed the crime against them, but then, you know, ran to his house and burnt the guy's house down and, you know, ran over his dog. It's unreasonably hostile people who go to the police expecting help, yet treat them like, you know, like garbage. So they find, you know, they go through the trash and they find some leads to, you know, link enough leads to link Emil Muzz to the case. And they go to the pier where they know Emil Muzz will have brought Jerry Caesar for his boat. And, you know, they're sitting in the car and they look over like, well, there's the limo and the limo driver. Yeah, and that's Emil Muzz. It's matches Edith Borden's description to a T.
Stupid looking. big and stupid looking.
Ugly. Stupid looking.
Yeah.
An exact match. And so they go up to the car to talk to him. They introduce themselves as officers and they say they want to have a word with them, but Emil Muzz just puts the car in drive, slams on the gas, and runs over Friday's feet, which, again, is played brilliantly by Dan Aykroyd, showing his feet being run over in agony. They run back to the car, and we get a pretty good action movie car chase.
Yeah, exactly. Like this, it doesn't suddenly turn into Beverly Hills Cop or anything, but yeah, it's solid.
We should point out, because again, we always get ahead of ourselves. They're conducting this police chase in a Ford Escort,
right,
because their original police vehicle had been stolen, mostly because the Pagans are on a rampage of stealing cars, but also because Strebeck left the keys in the ignition.
Yeah, which is on him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, Friday has every right to be pissed.
Friday has every right to be chewing Strebeck out about
yeah.
it.
He's like, Strebeck's like, calm down, it's a mistake. It's like, dude, come on.
No, that's a mistake nobody whoever has driven a car should be making.
Right.
I mean, again, I know it happens. Sure, I know some people, you know, but
the cop.
So we get a pretty good police, and then, you know, they're careening down the beach in, you know, endangering, you know, Friday's, you know, writing things down in his notebook about how, you know, flagrant disregard to public property, endangering the lives of civilians. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, he's really racking up the citations, isn't he? He's like, this isn't about him. It's about you, Strebeck. This is your one-way ticket to the back to civilian life, Mr. Throw the book out the window. And Strebeck says, that's a good idea. And he takes the book and throws it out the window.
Yep.
One of the things they go careening through is a huge stack of plush animals that go flying everywhere. And we should point out, Emil Muzz is having the best time causing all this destruction and driving through everything, laughing and cackling away. And I don't know why it strikes me as so funny.
Me either.
But as Strebeck and Friday go crashing through the plush animals, I think it's the way he gets. It's just the delivery of the line.
Exactly. It's just like, so brilliant in this.
Look out. Muppets.
Watch out, Muppets. Yeah.
It just makes me laugh.
It works every time. It just works every time. Even 40, you know, nearly 40 now years later.
So anyways, they end up, you know, all crashing into a lifeguard station, and they're able to arrest Emil and take him down to the station where he is less than cooperative.
Right. Kind of gross too.
He spits in Friday's face, and
it's kind of graphic too.
Is obviously not going to cooperate, you know. And he goes, Strebeck tries to kind of calm down the situation. He says, "You know what, Friday, we're obviously going to be here for a while. I could use a cup of coffee. Why don't you cool down and go get us a cup of coffee?" And he turns to Muzz and says, "Do you want anything?" And Muzz is very unpleasant. He demands chewing gum, Snickers bar, and my attorney, and expletive, and chucks the finger
badge
at
kisser.
Friday.
Actually, he doesn't swear. They just calls him Badge Kisser.
Badge Kisser, yeah.
Badge Kisser. But I like, before he leaves, I like Friday, Dan Aykroyd's line where he says something like, anyone who would represent you, don't worry about the door. Anyone who would represent you would just ooze under it.
Yeah. Yeah. So he goes out to get a coffee, and Tom Hanks very, very pleasantly says, "Well, I guess it's just too emo. I guess it's just you, me, your balls, and this drawer." And it shows him opening the drawer and then slamming it shut. And the look on Emo's face gives you a very clear idea of what has just happened. Right. And you hear several times the door slamming shut and Emo Muzz yelling in agony.
Right.
Which you would think would send, you know, at least some higher up into there. But everybody kind of knows what it is. And even Joe Friday has a little smile on his face.
He's fine.
Probably because he knows it's wrong and it's not something he would do himself because, you know, it's against the law. But he's obviously happy to let Strebeck do it. And, you know, again, he narrates most of the movie. You hear him narrating because he'll say, like, by the time I got back into the room, you know, Emo Muzz was singing like a canary, telling us everything he wanted to know. So they find out through Muzz where the next big pagan meeting is going to be. But that's all he's saying. And then Tom Hanks says, "You know what? Wouldn't a couple of Danishes go good with this coffee?" And he slides the drawer open again. So they decide that they're going to go to this pagan meeting in disguise as, you know, dressed exactly how gang members dress.
Yes,
according
to
research.
Well, and if the research is any other movie made in the 80s, it's not wrong.
Yes, they watched the opening to The Warriors and decided, like, yes, that's the...
that's about right. Death Wish, Death Wish 2, 3, yep, no, we got it.
Yep, dress them up like that, which, again, is part of the joke.
Right. Escape from New York, yep, exactly, that's what we're going for.
So they drive up to where the pagan meeting's going to be, and they're pulled over by a couple of cops who turn out to be pagan members in disguise, you know, trying to, you know, shoo away anybody from the area. Because it's like, oh, it's okay. Look, they're pagans. They're all card-carrying pagan members.
Literally, International Brotherhood of the Card. There's like a little card with picture.
With the picture.
And position. International Brotherhood of Pagans, member in good standing.
And Hanks is
that
undercover.
That just works for me. It really does. The fact they have cards, little cards, little photo cards.
He's undercover as Muzz with the fake mustache, who, of course, he doesn't really look enough like Muzz, but he's
not remotely.
I've been sick.
Yeah.
So, you know, they pull in and they're handed their issued their goat leggings.
Yep.
To
my
wear.
Favorite part of the movie.
They put those on and the guy comes along with a big tray of, you know, different types of pills, all different shapes and colors, and, you know, who knows what they're all for. But the best part is the big Titantron sign that says "People Against Goodness and Normalcy."
Yes.
P-A-G-A-N.
Pagan.
This is the place. You think?
Again, it's a nothing line, but just it's delivered perfectly. You know, they built up enough goodwill that it works. I'll even laugh at that.
The fact that, like, again,
every time.
Everything Joe Friday is so mad. There's no irony.
Nice work, Joe.
Yeah, it's just so matter of fact. And we find out that we should have mentioned also that, you know, the lovely Edith Borden mentioned that her wedding dress had been stolen by Emo Muzz as well.
The only thing endearing about him.
And out comes this guy, you know, obviously the leader of the pagans, wearing this enormous, you know, goat skull mask covering his identity, you know, talking about, you know, the Brotherhood of Pagans and, you know, how they're against, you know, the goodness of society and, They're there that night to offer a sacrifice. And one of the sacrifices, you know, one of the things he goes, like, with this bat, I consecrate. And they're like, oh, well, there's the fruit bat. With this lion's mane, I do consecrate. Well, there's the lion's mane. All we need now is a giant snake. And then they, like, they're going to sacrifice a virgin. And out comes Alexandra Paul, dressed in Edith Borden's wedding gown, which, you know, Strebeck says, you know, 10 to 1, that's Edith Borden's wedding gown. And Friday, who's immediately smitten by Connie Swale, played by Alexandra Paul, says, 100 to 1, Edith Borden didn't look nearly that beautiful on her wedding night. They push Connie Swale, and I will refer to her as the Virgin Connie Swale from then on, because that's how Joe Friday will refer
every time
to her, yep. Pushes her into the pit of water.
But
Strebeck and Friday, of course, rush to her rescue. They dive in, and Friday starts trying to help her stay above water, and Strebeck comes up. Joe, I found the snake.
Yeah.
They're struggling against the snake. The pagans are all cheering or jeering, depending on how the situation is going. Strebeck, who had taken a bunch of the drugs and put them in his pocket, grabs them out of his pocket, stuffs it in the snake, kills the snake, and they escape through a tunnel being chased by the pagans.
Now, just before that happens, you know, when he's doing the consecration and he's got the bat and the lion's mane, one of the lines that gets me every single time, it's like, it's one of the ones that I wait for when I watch this, is when he's going through his chant and all the different, you know, ingredients of the brew, and he finishes it with, evil bringeth here our plea, she's as pure as she can be, white and clean as driven snow, from Orange County, here we go.
The
from
way
Orange
he
County, here we go,
that
gets me every time. He's pumping up the crowd. He knows how to pump up the crowd.
Almost like a game show host.
Right. From Orange County. Here we go. Gets me every time.
I want to point, people will recognize Alexandra Paul from early seasons of Baywatch.
Right.
As well as 8 Million Ways to Die. And she played a double of the character she played in the final Baywatch movie, because her character was, I believe, eaten by a shark.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
No way. I had no idea. I never watched Baywatch, but I didn't know that.
I, you know, as much as the mocking I always did for Baywatch when it was on, and it was probably at the most popular, like, you know, the number one show in 7 countries. We were working, or at least I was working, the second shift at Wendy's and getting home at midnight, right. You know, showered and, you know, all wired from work and not ready to go to bed. And one of the things that was always playing was Baywatch, and darned if I didn't get hooked.
Yeah, no, I was probably playing like PlayStation or something, but yeah. It was hard to not, I mean, if you were watching TV, it was hard to not watch Baywatch because it was on a lot.
No, and, you know, again, it was, you know, a fun, you know, if
we grew up popular watching, for a reason, like I said, I just never watched it.
We grew up watching Chips, and it was almost the same type of formula, only on the beach and with the ocean.
But with the same like elaborate kind of disasters.
Yeah, there'd be some sort of huge disaster, and the lifeguards would grab that little orange floaty device and go running in slow motion to save the 100 people that just survived the offshore oil rig explosion.
Right, but what I was saying is it one of those ones where also, like, the precursor to the offshore oil rig explosion was, like, someone roller skating, and then, like, a wheel blew off their roller skates as someone turned into a thing, like a whole butterfly effect sort of situation?
Well, they would have those, but yeah, you know, so there was, I do remember a very silly sequence of, you know, Pamela Anderson standing and watching a bunch of bikers racing down the street one way and a bunch of rollerbladings racing down the street the other way, and her coming to the conclusion they're all going to collide. And I'm like, well, won't they see each other? Nope, she was right. They all collided.
So I just assumed roller skates or rollerblading was going to be part of it. Yeah.
All right, back to Dragnet.
Yeah, all right, fair enough.
So they're escaping down the tunnels, and they find themselves surrounded by the Pagans. But fortunately for them, the Pagans aren't armed, and Joe right. and Strebeck are. And Strebeck pulls out his oversized gun, and Friday pulls out his gun, and there's, of course, the joke, like, why is his so much bigger than yours? And he's like, ma'am, his gun. And Friday, I think, is the best response you could come up with is, I've never needed more.
Right.
Because let's face it, if you know where to put the bullet, doesn't matter the size of the gun.
Right.
So they escape. They drive the Virgin Connie Swale home. She lives in a very traditional neighborhood with little white picket fences to even Strebeck, you know, mocking, can Beaver come out and play? But it's, again, clear that both the Virgin Connie Swale and Joe Friday are absolutely smitten with each other. It is love.
Oh, she's so into him, yeah.
It is a meet cute. And we should go back to mention that, like, when they were interviewing Jerry Caesar and surrounded by all these beautiful women, one of the women comes up before Caesar leaves was the very first bait mate.
Sylvia Wiss, a.k.a. Frank Gardner, according to the narration.
And, you know, she, you know, again, it's PG-13, so we don't see it, but she, you know, she shows to Joe, like, are these the breasts of a 40-year-old woman? She is coming on to Joe Friday absolutely blatantly, but Friday isn't picking up on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Or if he is, he's not, I mean, he's all business. Like, you could read that either way. Like, because he's not stupid. And they don't play him off as being, like, oblivious. In other words, like, he knows what's going on. He knows if you're making fun of him. It's not like it's like that. He's not oblivious to anything. He just is, his convictions are pure. So, you know, you could almost read it as he's a policeman now. And that's just what he's going to be.
Right, but the point is that he is, the fact that he's so smitten with the Virgin Connie Swale shows that he is feeling emotions that he is completely unfamiliar with.
Right.
Like, he himself doesn't even seem to realize it. So they go back to the station to report to, you know, Captain Bill Gannon, who is, you know, one, not pleased that they called him at 3 a.m. to make this report. And two, that, you know, they're doing this ridiculous dance and Strebeck has a pocket full of drugs.
Again, that's another thing that just works for me. It's very simple and I don't know, maybe out of context, not very funny, but it's just their reenactment through the narration, of what was going on to the captain.
So they go back to the scene of the crime. And, of course, the Pagans have cleared every trace of any possible type of crime out of there. So when they get there, the police commissioner is very upset with, you know, Gannon and them. Like, you know, who are these idiots? You know, obviously nothing happened here. You know, why are they in charge of the case? And Bill Gannon, you know, kind of sticks up for him. Like, no, they're two of my best men. You know, I believe them. Something else must be going on. They also were following a thread between some chemicals that could be made for fertilizer that will also be can also be used as a poison gas, you know, that will, you know, after prolonged exposure to, will make your eyes water, your nose run, and you'll start to gag and gasp for air, which, again, Strebeck has to, you know, poke fun at Friday by saying, oh, like your aftershave.
Yeah. Trichloronitromethane and the pseudohalogenic compound cyanogen. It burns the eyes, lungs, and throat, causes vomiting, and if continuously inhaled, death.
So you made better points of remembering this stuff than I did.
Well, you repeat it at least twice, which just, again, it just works for me. It's such a simple thing.
Meanwhile, so they go back and as they're, you know, investigating the case, obviously the Pagans are onto who's investigating them, because they blow up their car as they're heading back, and Friday's like, very again, my hat was in that car. Well, I can tell you who just reblocked it for you now. And Friday mentions that, you know what, he needs a cup of coffee. And Strebeck says, well, I know where they make the best in town. And, of course, they end up at a strip club. And, again, you know, the stripper's up on stage. She's pole dancing, and she comes up on to Friday, who's drinking his cup of coffee and is, you know, dancing right in his face. And he's just like,
ma'am.
Strebeck comes over, sits down next to Friday, and Friday says, you know, I hate to admit it, Strebeck, but this is one damn good cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And Strebeck
says, he wasn't lying.
You should try the fresh French toast. But while Friday was enjoying his coffee and not enjoying the show, Strebeck got some information about where somebody could be mixing the chemicals that they're searching for. And so they get a warrant and an LAPD issued tank.
Right, like a battering ram, yeah.
And go crashing through a milk, not processing.
Dairy.
Pasteurization.
They're
obviously, you know, pasteurizing the milk at this this location. Pasteurizing and probably bottling it. But they come crashing through and, you know, they spill this, you know, we find out it's milk, but for what they all they knew, there was going to be this highly noxious gas.
Right.
And they go busting through, knocking these pipes apart, spraying this stuff everywhere. They come out wearing hazmat suits, where they then take off to sniff and drink
taste the liquid that's
pouring everywhere. And, you know, Strebeck's like, I can't quite place it. And Friday's like, it's milk. Fresh, wholesome milk. Just like the sign says. Good for your teeth and for strong bones. And, you know, of course, because they have the warrant, they don't have to, you know, really suffer any consequences. But still, there's a bit of destruction caused. And it turns out, well, they were kind of right, because in the very building next door, they were mixing the chemical. So the Pagans got one over on Joe Friday and Pat Strebeck once again.
Now, so, do we want to get into the controversial scene that was edited out previous to this? Or do you not want to?
Well, is that scene coming up yet?
I'm pretty sure it was before they bust into the plant that what
right.
They think is the chemical
I thought it was
plant.
After for some reason I was thinking it was after that
I figured you wanted to avoid the controversy, but I you know
it well would be... no well it was the if I don't know if it was re-put back in, but if you saw the movie in the UK, the scene we're about to discuss was exercised. Joe Friday was standing outside in the bad part of town waiting for Strebeck to show up. When
trigger warning, by the way.
What?
I'm just saying, let this, you know, prepare.
He's accosted by three punks who want to steal his wallet. And at first he's like, are you threatening me, son?
Yeah.
You know, he's completely, you know, like, why are these guys bothering me? And when they try to, you know, one pulls a knife and the other one pulls out nunchucks. And it was the nunchucks that made this scene get exercised from the UK print. Because even the Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles weren't allowed to carry nunchucks in Britain. But what's good about this scene is it shows that Friday can handle himself. Because he's able to take down these three punks without even breaking a sweat. And as they go running off into the night, he shakes his head on a school night, too.
I also like the fact that he's most of all disgusted that, or at least, you know, so he thinks, the Pagans would use the guise of wholesome milk for children as their cover. That just really burns him.
So, Strebeck asks, you know, after all that's said and done, Strebeck asks, you know, Friday if he wants to go for a beer or something. And he's like, no, I got plans. And he drops off Friday at his little motorcycle and drives off. And Strebeck's like, do I really care what he's doing tonight? Yes, of course I do. And he goes following after Friday and, you know, ends up at this, you know, another quaint little house. And I don't really get this part because Strebeck is like, I knew it. It's Elm Street. And that would make him Freddy Krueger. And one night the lighting's going to be bad. And he thinks I'm going to look pretty little co-ed. And out comes this claw. And they play the Psycho music.
Right.
And it makes me wonder if they wanted to use Psycho but couldn't for the, you know, maybe because of the you know, Universal Studios owns the rights. But this is a Universal film.
Right.
And New Line did the Nightmare on Elm Street films.
Right.
Maybe they thought kids would be more recognizable with Freddy Krueger, and probably I'm betting that the original idea was it was going to be he's Norman Bates, because it makes so much
it more makes sense, way more sense, yeah,
for him to assume he's Norman Bates. But yeah, it was probably because Freddy Krueger was more contemporary, and they threw it in there for, you know, the younger audience that would be watching.
Except for that, the reference seemed out of place. I think you're right, but I hadn't really thought about it. Although I did notice that, it seemed like an out of place reference with out of place music.
Yeah. So anyways, Joe Friday comes out the front door with the sweet little old lady, and he's like, oh my God, he's dating Mother Goose. And he goes running up, hi, Joe. And Friday is, of course, upset, like, what are you doing here, Strebeck? Oh, you know, I just was passing through the neighborhood. And, you know, you're going to introduce me? And it's like, not that it's any of your business, but this is my grandmother, and it's her birthday, and I'm taking her out for dinner. And he goes, it's so nice to meet you, Mrs. Friday. And again, Friday's like, again, not that it's any of your business, but this is my maternal grandmother. Her name is Monday. Wah, wah. So Strebeck gets invited along by Grandma Monday, and Friday's like, you know, kind of objecting, like, you know, I actually, you know, had invited somebody else with us, which is why I didn't invite Strebeck. And who did he invite but the Virgin Connie Swale? And both Strebeck and Friday's grandmother are, you know, both, you know, so pleased and happy that Joe's got himself a date.
Like parents,
with a lovely young girl. So they go to the Brown Derby for dinner. And, you know, while they're at the table, and, you know, Strebeck's kind of being a jerk, but, you know, not ruining the situation. You know, he's needling Friday, but he's being absolutely pleasant enough for, like, the grandmother and you know, Connie Swale, the Virgin Connie Swale, to be, you know, charmed. And everybody's enjoying themselves. But Friday, when they see across incomes, and they've shown this throughout the movie, these little excerpts on TV by the Reverend Worley, who's, you know, a crusader against, you know,
Mama.
Yes, Mama.
Is that like movement against? Was it? I can't remember now. but.
But, you know, he's one of those, you know, evangelical, everybody, you're all twisted and evil, and, you know, we gotta, you know, doesn't matter. But, you know, he's got a following. And in fact, his weekly program is among Joe Friday's favorites. And, you know, he's in town to, you know, also help the police commissioner who wants to run for mayor against the current mayor. And he's aiding in her campaign, you know, about how, you know, how horrible society is collapsing in L.A. And, you know, smut peddlers like, you know, Jerry Caesar are, you know, leading to the downfall of society. But regardless, the Virgin Connie Swale recognizes the Reverend Worley as the man that kidnapped her and pushed her into the snake pit. Now, Friday, you know, again, smitten by her, and just you could tell by the look on her face, she's 100% sure that he's the guy. And Strebeck is like, first of all, this guy is, you know, high profile. You can't just go over there and cuff him. Not to mention, he's having dinner with our captain and our police commissioner. But Friday is undeterred. He goes up and puts the cuffs on him, and of course is immediately slapped down by the commissioner and tells him to release the Reverend Worley, who, you know, which when he does, they all go storming out. And the commissioner demands Bill Gannon take Friday's badge, making him choke, gasp, a civilian again.
Right.
Strebeck says he's going to build the case, but Gannon says, nope, if I hear you're even, you know, within inches of this case, or within miles of this case, I'll take your badge too. So Strebeck takes Grandma Monday home for Friday so that Friday and Connie Swale can continue their evening together. Unfortunately, it's not long before Emil Musch shows up and demonstrates the fact he has super strength by turning over their car and capturing both the Virgin Connie Swale and Joe Friday. So when Joe Friday goes missing, we now get the voiceover done for us by Pep Strebeck. And he starts getting concerned himself, and he starts looking into the disappearance of Joe Friday. And he remembers a clue they found earlier about with a picture taking place at Muscle Beach, where he goes and finds Emil Muzz working out, pulls his gun on him, and demands the location of Joe Friday. While this is all going on, we should point out we learn that not only is there a conspiracy between Jerry Caesar and the Reverend Worley, there's a conspiracy between the Reverend Worley and the police commissioner. Reverend Worley has set up Jerry Caesar to make him believe that once the commissioner is put in charge and the mayor of LA, you know, people who will, they're going to basically split the society between the two of them. You know, there'll be the, you know, upright, you know, evangelicals who will donate money to the Reverend Worley to, you know, put an end to the, you know, pornography that's, you know, being peddled by people like Jerry Caesar. And Jerry Caesar will be getting the money from all the, you know, people who support that stuff. There was a very odd mayoral debate, too, that the commissioner wants to make her point that the mayor isn't fit to be mayor because of the crime that runs rampant in the streets. Which, if anything, you would think, aren't you the police commissioner?
Right.
If crime is running rampant in the streets, shouldn't we be looking for a new police commissioner and maybe not so much a new mayor?
Right. New commissioner, new captain, yeah.
Yeah.
New sheriff, yeah.
But anyways, we find out that the Reverend Worley plans to, you know, kill off Jerry Caesar as well and control the whole everything. You know, he'll be raking in the money from the pornography and raking in the money from the people who want to stop the pornography. He'll be running them both. So Strebeck finds out that the Virgin Connie Swale and Joe Friday are being held at the Griffin Observatory. I guess probably just to get another L.A. landmark in there. I don't know.
Yeah. But, yeah. No,
I don't
if
think
you,
the Reverend Worley has control over the Griffin Observatory.
Yeah. If you establish yourself in a major city, you have to. You have to go through at least a few landmarks.
So he goes there to rescue them. But before he gets there, Reverend Worley once again takes Connie Swale with him, the Virgin Connie Swale with him, as a hostage. And heads off to the 25th anniversary for Bait Magazine gala that's being held at Jerry Caesar's mansion. Strebeck gets there in time to rescue Joe Friday from being executed. You know, they take on a couple of bad guys and then escape on Strebeck's motorcycle heading for the Caesar mansion. at the Caesar Mansion, you know, there's, you know, a lot of smoozing and, you know, drinks going around, having a good time. And it seems like, you know, the Reverend Worley makes it look like, yeah, he's sealing his deal with Jerry Caesar. He takes his leave from the limo, and as he's leaving, you see that Emo Muzz and the Pagans are setting up to launch the noxious gas into Caesar's mansion, killing everybody there, as well as burning all the stolen magazines, 25th issue of Bait, and making sure that, you know, once again, the Pagans take the credit for it, because again, this will, you know, be again, help cement Reverend Worley's standing in the community. Strebeck and Friday get there just in time to see the Worley leave, and Strebeck goes in alone because, as he points out to Friday, that, you know what, he's a civilian now, he doesn't have a badge, and that, you know, he can't go in there. And he plays on, you know, Friday's sense of law and order to convince him that, yeah, he has to leave. So Friday goes off, you know, to call for, Friday goes off to go home and, you know, wait the whole situation out. Strebeck goes in, figures out the situation, calls Captain Gannon and has the cavalry show up. And now we get our big action movie section. You know, we get a shootout between SWAT and the Pagans.
Brilliant tacticians they are, hiding behind an iron gate.
It seems to work out for them.
It does.
They get the cops pinned down.
Luckily, no one's firing actual bullets, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the SWAT's trying to storm the place. Strebeck's, you know, stops the gas. The SWAT is pinned down, but all of a sudden that battering ram tank shows up, starts drawing fire and batters down the gate, scattering the Pagans so that SWAT team can, you know, rally and, you know, take up position. And out of the tank comes Joe Friday, and we get possibly the worst joke of the movie.
He tries, though. He does.
Strebeck yells, "Thank God,
yeah,
it's Friday."
Yeah. He does, though. He tries. Like, I can't, it's not Tom Hanks' fault. He does the best he can with it.
Friday comes out toting a shotgun, blasting away at the Pagans. Muzz and Strebeck get into a bit of a fight. As Strebeck goes to grab his gun, Muzz steps on his hand and is about to shoot Strebeck when Friday puts his shotgun in Muzz's face and says, "Don't you know that's my partner?" And he kind of saves himself. Tom Hanks kind of saves himself with his little despite his hand being stepped on. The situation is quickly wrapped up at the Caesar State, and we get our last glimpse of the great Dabney Coleman, still flanked by the two, the two bait mates.
Nailing every scene he's in.
Yep, who comes up to Friday like, "You know what? You saved my house, you saved my money, you saved my life. Anything I can do for you, I'll do it. You can get your hands off my jacket." Okay.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And, you know, Strebeck and Friday realized that the Virgin Connie Swale isn't there, and that Worley still has her. They'll have to go get her, and they go running off. And Dabney Coleman, you know, even in his stealing the last scene where he just, you know, talks to the two ladies like, "You know, you too hungry? Let's go get something to eat."
Yep, without missing a beat. "You hungry?" Yeah.
They've just met, you know, survived a firefight and, you know, almost being killed by poison gas, but you know what?
Oh, you're just hungry,
move
you're
ahead
hungry
with your evening.
Yeah.
Now we get the part that it's not a chase, but a race to the airport, as, you know, they find out that Worley's got a plane waiting for him there, so they, you know, commandeer a police car and go racing through the city towards the airport. This time, Friday's driving. And again, a lot had been made about how Friday drives like a grandma. He drives slower than the speed limit.
Like 8 miles under the speed limit, yep.
He's very cautious, you know. Strebeck was the reckless, you know, racing through. But now, because the Virgin Connie Swale life is in danger, he puts the pedal to the metal and goes racing down, you know, through the streets. And Strebeck's all like, be careful, Joe. This is a dangerous road. And it just doesn't work for me that after the chase we saw him driving through earlier, that Strebeck is this panicked over Fridays.
Right. Maybe it's different if you're a passenger, but no, it does seem forced. It's it's played out as well as it can be with the two actors, like the bit where Strebeck and him are singing Good King Wenceslas. I mean, it amuses me. It still works, but you're right. It does seem it's forced.
I mean, I know they're just trying to make that like, all right, Friday's gone loose cannon now. Right. You don't know what but maybe if they'd done a little bit more with the stunt driving, like maybe had the police car like jumping over other cars and intersections.
Right.
And maybe spinning out a bit more. But he's not doing anything. I think it's even safer than what Strebeck was doing earlier in the movie.
Probably, yeah.
It's a nitpick, but it's there. Unfortunately, they arrive too late. And the Reverend Worley gets away with the Virgin Connie Swales, although not before delivering a little bit of the comeuppance to the police commissioner, who he abandons on the tarmac as he pulls away in the airplane. So Friday and Strebeck are left standing on the runway as he flies off, as the Reverend Worley flies off with the Virgin Connie Swales, and it almost looks like, are we going to get a Chinatown-style ending here? Nope, because as they're flying off to Mexico and he's got the Virgin Connie Swale tied up next to her, they get pulled over by an LAPD.
LAPD, yeah.
LAPD fighter jet.
Yeah.
Little blue light and sirens and all.
It's great. And this is an 87, so God knows what they must have now. Like low-yield nukes, LAPD, you know, fighter jet.
It doesn't make a lick of sense because really when you forget about them, whether or not the LAPD has a fighter jet.
Right.
All the Reverend really has to think is like, are they going to shoot me down? Not with Connie Swale. I'll just fly to Mexico.
I'll just keep going. Can. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
But, you know, instead, you know, he pulls over and the Reverend is arrested. And we get, you know, again, the classic dragnet ending, you know, where like, you know, the court proceedings went, and you know the Reverend Worley was convicted of 47 different felonies and crimes, and is doing, you know, 7 99 year sentences, which means he'll be eligible for parole in 9 years. And you know, we get our happy ending with you know, the next morning, you know, Friday Strebeck are walking up the stairs into the police precinct because, you know, he's got his badge back, you know, again, and put him back on the force. And Friday yawns a little bit. And Strebeck's like, whoa, were you up late last night? I thought the Christian Science reading room closed at 7. And Joe Friday just turns to him and is like, not that it's any of your business, but I happened to spend a pleasant evening with Connie Swale last night. And Strebeck's like, don't you mean the Virgin Connie Swale? And then you get the famous dragnet sting, ba-da-da-dun, as Friday looks knowingly at Strebeck, and Strebeck's, you know, gets a little jolt, and then that's the end of our movie. And it cuts to the rap, City of Crime, performed by Dan Aykroyd and Tom Hanks. You can find it on YouTube. Look up City of Crime, Dragnet, Tom Hanks and Dan Aykroyd. You will not be disappointed.
It has a video and everything.
Yeah. Fantastic. And thus ends, you know, a very, very enjoyable movie that, like I said, if you're a fan of the Dragnet TV show, yeah, it pokes fun at it, but it's a loving homage.
Yeah, and I would say so. Cool, because it doesn't make it doesn't. I mean, yes, as much as it's poking fun at the conventions of the Dan Aykroyd's character, it's not. It's also kind of not. It's just showing like how things look in a 1987 lens.
Yeah, I mean, and Dan Aykroyd as Joe Friday is no doubt the hero of the film.
Right, and more than competent. Yeah, like he's never shown as incompetent or stupid, you know.
No, no, not like, you know, some of the movies that would, you know, parody. He's no, he's no Drebin.
Right, he's no buffoon.
Although even Drebin was kind of, you know, he was more of the accidental buffoon. But, you know, yeah, he's a good cop. He's a good cop in the City of Angels.
Yep.
And even if you aren't really familiar with the traps and tropes of Dragnet, it's still an enjoyable movie because, like I said, we grew up watching it without having a real
familiarity
with the show. I swear in my head I can say these words with no problem. Somehow from brain to tongue, it just goes like, you don't need to know how to say this. They know what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, it's not perfect. And, you know, it's also, especially at its time, I mean, it's up against a lot of, you know, now legendary comedies of its time. It is uneven at points, you know, like not every joke lands, but the ones that do have stuck with me. You know, and the performances, especially the performances to me are just so, I think acting in comedy can be underrated, like so much is put on the writing, you know, as it should be. But the delivery of those lines have to work. And every line is delivered just perfectly in this. Even ones that might not work in other movies work here. Again, not all of them. And you know, if you're talking like, you know, 80s comedies, this is, I guess I don't know how I would rank it, but I mean, there's a lot, you know, but this was a fun one to rewatch. You know, I think it holds up for me. Maybe some of it's nostalgia. I don't know, but there's a lot of stuff that just still works for me really well in this movie.
The banter between Tom Hanks and Dan Aykroyd is pitch perfect throughout the movie. So it's worth watching it for that alone.
Oh,
and it's a shame that not only did we not get a sequel with Hanks and Aykroyd returning, I would have loved to have seen Hanks and Aykroyd in a movie together, regardless as to whether it was a sequel. You know, they were obviously played off each other extremely well.
They were a great pairing. Again, I could listen to Friday all day. I just love the way he talks.
And everybody, like we said, everybody in it, whether they have one tiny little scene or not, plays their scene perfectly.
Oh, yeah. They're living in those characters. They're having a good time. Or at least I hope they were. You know, like Dabney Coleman, you know, I hate to think the set was some sort of nightmare, right? And everybody was difficult to work with. Because when you see Christopher Plummer playing the Reverend, it's like you could just feel like he's having such fun with this character. And Dabney Coleman seemed to be having such fun with the Jerry Caesar character.
Well, Christopher Plummer has, like, the greatest character you can play. You know, somebody who's, you know, smarmy and is both, you know, the villain, but, you know, is undercover as this, you know, evangelical, you know, religious leader as well.
Right.
You know, and he's trying to play, you know, what would be all charming and all that. But like, even the actress that plays April in her little scene with, you know, like you said, Mr. Silly.
Mr. Silly.
she's excellent in for that little silly.
Exactly. And, you know,
every performance is whoever played Grandma Mundy, is she so sweet and charming? Yep. You know, she comes out of nowhere. Alexandra Paul as the Virgin Connie Swale, she is so believable as this little innocent, sweet innocent woman who doesn't seem like she got very far out of her neighborhood.
No.
Despite the fact of being obviously in at least her 20s.
Yeah.
But, you know, she's completely, you know, believable. She's perfect. And when she sees the Reverend and identifies him, she looks like she's on the verge of tears. Like she's terrified that, you know, right there, just a few yards away, is the person who kidnapped her and pushed her into a pool with an anaconda as a sacrifice. She was again, before I settled, like I said, I considered Dabney Coleman. I considered Jack O'Halloran. But then I was really going to give it to Alexandra Paul. But then when I just kind of flipped through everything in my mind, again, I had to say, no. Edith Borden was the standout performance.
It was especially the same for me.
Especially again, since it is, you know, more fitting to the Whip-Bissell Award.
Agreed.
Because Connie Swale is a main role.
Yep. Yeah, that's what made it a little bit easier to not pick Christopher Plummer and Dabney Coleman, especially. But like you, like as I was thinking through it, for whatever reason, well, I mean, it's a great performance, but like in my mind just kept going back to Kathleen Freeman's performance. And just again, just her perfect delivery of all these elaborate and creative insults that change each time. It's one of the more memorable scenes of the movie to me. Like I always love it when, you know, when I'm watching it, and when I watched it again for the first time in a long time, I recognized it immediately because as they were walking up to the hotel and you hear the narration of where it's going. It's like, oh, I remember this part. This is great, and it absolutely still delivers.
Yeah, no, this is, I don't want to say it's a forgotten movie, but, you know, it's not something that I will admit it's not a movie I think about very often.
Well, yeah. I mean, part of the reason for that, right, is, you know, between Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, and Chevy Chase alone, and then, you know, just from that, you know, cast, right, from that Saturday Night Live cast, and then later, but in the same decade with Eddie Murphy, it does get lost in that shuffle, and probably deservedly so, you know, because if you're comparing it to, say, you know, Vacation or
Ghostbusters or Beverly Hills Cop, yeah,
right? Like it's very good, but if you're ranking it against some of these giants, it's, you know,
no, but again, the performance in this, the performances in this outshine, I would say, Ghostbusters and Beverly Hills Cop and Vacation.
It's tough to say character for character because that's tough to say because, like, as much as I absolutely love Lewis Skolnick and every single word he says in Ghostbusters, I don't know. Dabney Coleman is so great, and just like even just the first scene that you see with Christopher Plummer, where he's giving the interview or whatever on a show, and he's just kind of like laughing at his own jokes, and he's just all full of himself. It's just brilliant. I mean, but yeah, you're right. Like the performances are so strong. I don't know. That's tough.
And not enough can be said about Dan Aykroyd as Joe Friday.
Yeah, he's living that role.
That being said, is there anything else you would like to say about Dragnet?
No, other than again, I'm glad that it's something that was worth the rental space in my head ultimately, right? Because I remember seeing it in the theater. I really liked it. I remember watching it again on HBO an awful lot, and then I just didn't kind of think about it for, I don't know, the better part of two or three decades. What made me think about it was thinking of movies for this podcast. So I picked it up. And I'm glad that for as much as I remembered and thought I liked it, like I was rewarded with that, you know. Not that, like, you know, sometimes it doesn't work out that way. Sometimes you rewatch a movie and it's just like, I'm just not really feeling it. It's like it's not the end of the world or anything like that. But it's nice when it does hold up.
Yeah. You know, for me it was, you know, we talk about Shout Factory all the time, and Shout Factory put out a nice Blu-ray for this a short while back, and that's what brought it to reminded me of the movie, and I picked up the Blu-ray, and yes, I'm glad to have it in my collection. It's got some commentaries and other nice little special features in it. All right, so with that, we move on to our exploitation retitling of the movie. And for me, I'm real quick. I'm going to use the title of the rap song that Dan Aykroyd and Tom Hanks use, and it's going to be City of Crime, the pagan sacrifice of the Virgin Connie Swale.
Right on. I have City of Angels, City of Sacrifice.
Nice. Okay. Move on to recommendations.
Do you want to do... so we'll do Magnificent Seven last? Okay. Recommendations for me? Geez, I mean... On the one hand, you could say almost, and again, just like I mentioned, just these four actors alone for movies in the 80s, especially comedies, or even, you know, through the 90s, any of the Bill Murray or Dan Aykroyd or Chevy Chase or Eddie Murphy's you might find. I mean, most of them are gold. Again, you know, your Vacation or What About Bob or Groundhog Day or, you know, we covered Beverly Hills Cop and so on. But I want to go with Brady Bunch, both the TV show and the brilliant movie. if you're not familiar with the Brady Bunch movie, I'm going to assume you're familiar with the Brady Bunch show because I'm going to assume you listened to our podcast episode about it at minimum. But the Brady Bunch movie is just fantastically done. I mean, it just transplants the Brady Bunch family as they were, exactly as they were in the 60s. But just places them in the mid-90s, and that's it. Like, there's nothing, they just still live like it's the 60s, dress like it's the 60s, act like it's the 60s, and it just works. I've only seen the first two. I liked both of them. I understand there's, what, four of them there?
Well, there were two theatrical movies, and then there was the third one, which was a TV movie, The Brady Bunch in the White House with... Shelley Long and Michael Cole returning as Mike and Carol Brady, but they had to recast all the kids because it was, you know, unfortunately a too late long after, and all the kids had kind of outgrown the roles.
Right on. And the other one will be both Dark Shadows, the Dan Curtis TV show, and Dark Shadows, the movie based on the Dan Curtis TV show by Tim Burton.
Yeah, I'm going to go along the similar route and recommend the Starsky and Hutch movie that starred Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson.
Right on.
Because it kind of, you know, it's the kind of the same theme. And, of course, you know, the Beverly Hills Cop series.
Yep.
And the Bad Boys series with Will Smith and Martin Lawrence.
They keep making those. I'll keep watching them.
Yeah, there's another one coming out, a fourth one coming out.
I know it's Michael Bay and Jerry Bruckheimer, but I don't know what to tell you. I will watch every single one of those movies.
We have
I will watch those. Them. I will watch a Jerry Bruckheimer Michael Bay movie. I will, and I will enjoy it. Not every single one, but I will enjoy many of them.
I mean, those are comedic action movies where this is an action comedy as opposed to. But you know, it's all good and it's all fun. All right, so yeah, now we wrap things up as usual with The Magnificent 7 Degrees, where we connect this movie to my favorite movie, The Magnificent Seven, in 7 steps or less.
I thought of a fourth, actually, as well. Can I do all four, or should I just pick one?
Oh, just pick one.
Okay. I'm going to go with the one I thought of last, because I totally forgot he was in this movie, but it came to me. So Dan Aykroyd, he was in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom with Harrison Ford, who was in Dead Heat and the Merry-Go-Round with James Coburn.
Nice. Yeah. All right, I'm going to go with Jack O'Halloran, who played Emo Muzz.
Yep.
And what is probably his most famous role as Non in Superman and Superman 2,
yep.
Which, you know, writer-director Tom Mankiewicz did some script work on those movies as well. Gene Hackman was, of course, in Superman 1 and Superman 2 as Lex Luthor, and Gene Hackman also appeared with James Coburn in the Western Bite the Bullet.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, and just to get it out there for anyone thinking it and perhaps shouting it at their iPod or whatever, we know Dabney Coleman was in Towering Inferno with Steve McQueen, but we didn't want to reuse that.
Yeah.
I decided to go with the Dan Aykroyd one because the Christopher Plummer one to Night of the Generals I've used before. And just because I think it's interesting. So the one of the writers, I think Dan Aykroyd and someone else also have writing credit on this, but the one of the writers and also the director of the movie, Tom Mankiewicz, wrote The Eagle Has Landed, which was directed by John Sturges, the director of The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, there were plenty of ways to go. And I know I've used the Gene Hackman and Bite the Bullet with James Coburn before as well.
Yeah, whatever.
So with that, well, I also want to, you know, announce that Todd and I also, we don't appear on a podcast, you don't see us, but we're also taking part in a podcast called Mask Faces and Secret Bases, all for just 75 cents. This is a podcast about comic books where we join host Mick Jamison to talk about comic books. And you can find that podcast anywhere you're finding this podcast. If you're into comic books, we got about 4 episodes out. We've done one on the death of Gene D. Wolfe. We've done one on Now Comics, the Now Comics publishing of the late 80s, early 90s, and an episode on the superpowers. So if you enjoy listening to our wonderful voices talk on and on about pop culture, there's another place you can go listen to us. That's the Masked Faces and Secret Bases, all for just 75 cents podcast. You can follow us on X, Threads, Blue Sky, Instagram, and best of all, Letterboxd at Movie Matt Sirois, all one word, MovieMattSirois. And we all, as always, we thank you for listening and hope to have you back next time.
Thank you, everyone.
Stay gold, people.